This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 116 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are you?
Hi, David. Doing well. Doing a little bit of traveling this week, so recording on the road. But I'm really excited about this episode.
I am, too. This has been on my bucket list for about a year now, and I don't want to waste any time. I think you should introduce our guest.
Fantastic. Our guest is John Murphy, Jr. He's the Deputy Director, National Air Security Operations for U.S. Customs and Border Protection out of the Office of Air and Marine Operations, or AMO. Now, John's responsible for providing oversight, mission alignment, and associated administrative requirements for national and foreign operations involving the P-3 Orion and the MQ-9 Predator. Now, John's got over 4,000 hours of flight time. We'll put some more of his history in the show notes, but he comes from a 20-year career in the United States Marine Corps, and in 1996, he joined the former U.S. Customs Service as a customs pilot. He was promoted to Aviation Group Supervisor. He led many P-3 detachments to Central and South America, conducting counter-narcotic defense operations. Then in 2005, he was selected as Director of Air Operations at the San Diego Air and Marine Branch. Finally, in 2010, he served as Vice Director for the Joint Interagency Task Force South. That was responsible for the coordination of air and marine operations aviation support for the U.S. Southern Command anti-drug initiatives. John, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's good to be with you. You're making me feel old with all that history of myself.
Oh, and that's just the selected short version, as I mentioned. We'll have much more in the show notes.
Thank you.
Well, John, let's get started. Borders and Customs Patrol actually fly UAVs. Do you want to talk a little bit about the program, and then we'll move on to a little bit about dispelling the myths, but UAVs and for Borders and Customs Patrol, what are you guys doing with them?
Sure, gentlemen. So with Customs and Border Protection, back in 2005, we identified a need, a gap, if you will, for wide area surveillance along the U.S. border. So we looked in with industry and what appeared to be the right fit for us with a large unmanned aerial system was the General Atomics Predator, remote piloted aircraft, the MQ-9. Now, it's quite a bit different than the DoD version. The internal components are completely different. The software internally is suited for law enforcement operations, as well as the payloads that we operate with. Our mission profiles, we fly at very high altitudes as wide area surveillance would sound like. That being said, we're at flight level 200 and above. Some of the issues that we deal with quite a bit are civil liberties and civil rights. We operate this aircraft right at the border, and the things that we're able to see are things like backpacks, or we're able to see if a threat is carrying a weapon, or we're able to see if there are bundles in the back of a vehicle, or we can tell the difference between a quadruped and a biped with respect to the different payloads that we use. And when I say payloads, I'm talking about the different sensors. So I'm talking about things like electro-optics, like cameras or infrared, or I'm talking about synthetic aperture radar that's allowed, that gives us the capability of ground mapping target indicators, or I'm talking about sensors that are used in the maritime environment. So we utilize the MQ-9, and we have a maritime variant that we call the Guardian.
So these are flown over the land borders as well as the ocean borders?
So, Customs and Border Protection, our job is to stop bad people and bad things from coming into the United States, or departing for that matter. So we focus our operations, right at the U.S. border, but at the same time, this is a tremendous capability for us. You talked about the fact that I was a former officer in the Marines, and I've been a federal agent for the last 20 years. And, I know what I see, and I know what I witness with respect to what the capabilities are with this aircraft. When you've got the ability to fly for 20 hours with different special payloads that we operate with, and if you're able to focus that capability with respect to our mission set at the border or beyond the border, that gives you just a very powerful tool with respect to fighting crime and stopping threats that are heading towards the United States.
John, I can imagine that this must represent an increase in capability in an order of magnitude over what was done previously. And what was that was done previously? Were these same kinds of operations performed by manned aircraft, or do the unmanned aircraft now just represent completely new capabilities?
Well, I'd say a portion of the mission is performed by man because, one, they're not going to be able to fly for nearly as long. We're talking at best, even with our largest aircraft, which is the P-3 Orion, you're looking at a 10-hour aircraft as opposed to a 20-hour aircraft with respect to the unmanned aerial systems. Endurance is the key. It is a game changer for us. And, it's also a technological advantage because we try to do things smarter. And everything is integrated together at the border in the development or the fusing of information. So the MQ-9 operations at the border is a tool that's going to integrate with other tools such as unattended ground sensors, such as remote video surveillance systems or mobile video surveillance systems, or sensors that are on infrastructure such as fencing or integrated fixed towers, or that manned aircraft that's flying out there and pushing out video as well. So the idea is to take all that information and to pull it together into a common operating picture. So the UAS is a big part of that situational awareness or that wide area surveillance that brings it down to probably a medium area surveillance all the way down to your unattended ground sensors so that you can increase situational awareness to the agent on the ground so that you can tactically position them to deal with the threat that's coming across the border.
One of the things that I'd like you to address is you're talking about data manipulation and data and all of the data that it is getting. What kind of misconceptions are out there, and how do you handle privacy issues? You're surveying the border. Part of the border is the United States. Part of the border is a foreign country. You have to walk the fine line on privacy concerns for United States citizens versus the other territories. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the misconceptions and how are you handling the privacy issues that would go along with this?
That's a good question, because when you talk about misconceptions, and first of all, I don't think there's any misconception with respect to the mission set of Customs and Border Protection. It's exactly what it is, and our name speaks for itself. I think when you talk specifically about some of the tools that we have, such as the MQ-9 Predator, I think the misconceptions come a little bit from, it could be from Hollywood, could be from the mission sets that Department of Defense utilized the aircraft for. You've got to remember, this is absolutely nothing but another aircraft for us in a law enforcement tool, and we use it as such. We don't put any sensors on that aircraft that invades personal information or identification. There are no P2 issues with this aircraft because our flight profiles, and we're certificated to fly very high altitudes. And like I said, we're not going to be able to tell who a person is. We're not going to be able to tell their facial features. We're not going to be able to read their name on their jacket or anything like that. But we are going to be able to see if they're carrying a weapon. We are going to be able to see if they're carrying bundles, things of that nature. When we operate overseas, mostly it's in the maritime environment. We're going after, semi-submersible, vessels that are carrying 7,000 pounds of cocaine. They're coming up the source and transit areas towards the Central and Central America, Mexico, and the United States. So it is a whole of government approach because these countries that we work with, and I'll give you an example, the country of El Salvador or Honduras, we work closely with their government, and we are very open with respect to how we're going to utilize this aircraft, and we're very open with our architecture to them, so they can see where we operate and how we operate, and and the good that it's doing with respect to stopping the flow of drugs or weapons or human trafficking that's creating death, destruction, and corruption in their respective countries. So good relationships. We work through the embassies. We work through the respective governments, and we have a lot of positive results. I can tell you for the short period of time that we did deploy to Central America, we seized over 5,000 pounds of cocaine, and along the border this year we seized over 66,000 pounds of marijuana, and very effective tool for us in the fight against narco-terrorism and other things that are bad for the world.
John, one of the things that David and I talk about a lot on this program is integration of UAS into the national airspace, particularly with respect to small UAS. But you're already integrated, I guess. How does that work? How are you able to conduct flight operations in the national airspace and not interact negatively with manned or other aircraft?
Well, that's a super question. I tell you, I was just at an architectural review committee meeting yesterday where you had industry. This was specifically with respect to unmanned aerial systems and the integration into the national airspace. So obviously FAA is a big player. You had industry there, all sorts of different companies represented, as well as different associations. That's the approach that they're taking with respect to the development of Part 91 general operations, the development of Part 61 with manned operations, Part 62 that's going to be unmanned operations, Part 60, how our simulator is going to play with respect to the development of a remotely piloted aircraft, Part 121. And, I'll tell you that the Airline Pilots Association has a great deal of input with respect to the development of these rules and regulations and certifications that are coming down. So I just want to throw that out there. interesting how you know, these new precedents are being established with respect to the UAS community. But so how do we do it? You know, we follow the rules just like everybody else does. We file the 333 forms. We file and obtain certificates of authorization through the FAA, and they are a great partner for us. And we are very forthcoming with respect to where we fly and how we fly. And I think it's perhaps a little easier for us because our mission is right at the border, and there is not a lot of general aviation right at the border, and we fly at very high altitudes. So I think it's a little bit easier for, you know, the FAA to cut out the certificate of authorization for us. And we've been, you know, we've been working with them for, you know, such a long time at this point, over 10 years, with respect to unmanned aerial system operations. In some cases in industry, I think it's about doing the minimum in order to enter unmanned aerial systems into the national airspace. For us, it's about doing the maximum. What kind of components can we place on our aircraft to give us the greatest amount of situational awareness, whether that would be to identify another flying aircraft that's out in front of us 50, 25 miles away, or whether, just using, normal procedures, working with air traffic control. So we treat these aircraft just like any other aircraft, and the folks that remotely pilot our aircraft are the same folks that fly our P-3s and the same folks that fly our A-STARs and the same folks that used to fly our Citation jets. And from that, we get a very high-quality spread of talented pilots, you know, that are controlling these very expensive aircraft for us.
John, I think it's fascinating that it's the same population of pilots that's flying both the manned and the unmanned aircraft. Is that what I heard you say?
Absolutely. One way to keep a pool or a high-quality spread of aviators flying our aircraft is to utilize the same folks that are flying, you know, our P-3 missions or our Black Hawk missions or our Citation jet missions or our A-STAR missions. Qualified pilots, dual-rated pilots, in many cases, are the same folks that are at the controls with our unmanned aerial systems, with our MQ-9.
John, does that also, do you also swap your sensor operators also? Are they multi mission compatible, I guess, where the sensor operators for your MQ-9s would also be on your AEW&C P-3s?
They really are. I mean, these are highly talented detection enforcement officers that work very complicated radar systems. I know this because as a P-3 guy, I used to go back there and help these folks out, and quite frankly, I didn't know a tenth of what they knew. And some of these folks, not only can they, you know, operate the radar systems, they can build the radar systems. That's how good they are. And yes, these same folks that are working as detection enforcement officers, air enforcement agents that have a background from the military, operating military and controlling military aircraft, are the same folks that are back there also working as a sensor operator for our MQ-9 operation. So very, very talented individuals, also working with some, you know, very talented contractors from General Atomics. It's just an incredibly professional team that doesn't ever want to make a mistake.
I guess the next question will dovetail off of that is, I know that this will make the other people in the room very happy. So talk to me a bit about careers in CPB and Air and Marine, especially UAVs. We've got a lot of people who listen who want a career in UAVs or drones and want and this might be a route that they want to go. What advice would you give them?
Let's talk about that. We're looking for motivated individuals, people with a very high sense of ethics. We're going to hire a federal agent first. We're hiring law enforcement agents first. Then it's going to be a pilot second. So we're going to utilize the VRA. We're going to utilize open vacancy announcements in USA Jobs. We're looking into industry to get very talented individuals in to become a federal agent and then become a pilot for Customs and Border Protection. One of the things I wanted to throw out there right now was we currently have a vacancy announcement out, a job announcement number, which is Air Interdiction Agent 15-5. That is at USA Jobs, and there are various openings throughout the Southwest, the United States, and the Caribbean. So we are actively hiring. Let me tell you about the requirements as well. The requirements as of right now are, we're looking at 1,500 hours of flight time, FAA medical certificate, need a first class, and then after that, it would become a second class. And we're looking for FAA commercial pilots. That being said, we're also looking into the future, for kids that are in the academic world at the universities that are learning to remotely pilot aircraft through places such as University of North Dakota or Embry-Riddle that are starting up new unmanned aerosystem programs. We're looking at ways to incorporate, the universities into the hiring process to Customs and Border Protection. But that is down the road. That's going to require our human resources to develop that program. And, we see that as a great, avenue of approach for getting some real talented individuals into Customs and Border Protection for building the future.
Since you brought up the future, let's talk a little bit about the future. Two questions. One, do you think Customs and Border Patrol will start integrating small UASs as a tool, maybe for their for your officers on the ground? And I guess the second question is, the bad guys always figure out how to use them too. What do you see about prevention of people using UASs as the bad guys?
Yeah, hey, those are some tough questions. Not the first one. That's pretty easy. We are looking into the application of small UAS. We are working a study right now. Customs and Border Protection is working a study through the U.S. Border Patrol for application of the small UAS at the border. We see it as a tool where, a couple of agents are working a large ravine and having the ability to launch a UAS to see movement on the other side of a ravine, might be very advantageous to us. But again, we're working that program with Department of Homeland Security, Science and Technology to see, what's feasible, what will work, and what won't work with respect to small UAS operations. In terms of small UAS prevention, I don't think the threat at the border is the same as the threat to, high security public buildings and it's something that absolutely has a great deal of attention within the U.S. government on how to, prevent an attack from a small UAS. It's one that's not specifically in my world. It's not one where, I can speak with any authority to. What I can speak to is at the U.S. border. And we have had instances where small UASs were being used by the criminal element for, a variety of reasons, whether it would be to move a package across the border or whether it would be to observe where law enforcement is positioned. So we're looking at ways to counter that. Again, it's going to take more research and probably it's going to Department of Homeland Security, Science and Technology is the best entity to speak with respect to that.
All right. Well, John, where can our listeners learn more about Customs and Border Protection, or maybe specifically the Office of Air and Marine Operations? Is there a place online where they can go?
We do. We have a website. You can Google it, and you'll see our mission set. It's right on cbp.gov, and it will clearly show Customs and Border Protection, Air and Marine Operations.
All right, and we'll have links to that in the show notes, of course. And also, we see that CBP has a presence on Twitter and Instagram and other social media outlets like that, too.
Yes, sir.
All right, so we'll put links to those in the show notes. Well, David, what do you think? Interesting. You know, I have to say that the CBP seems like it's a pretty forward-thinking organization, certainly in terms of embracing and utilizing this new technology.
Yeah, and I'm glad we've gotten the opportunity. I know that we've had discussions about Customs and Border Patrol in news articles about using them and supporting other divisions of the government, but it is really fascinating, and I really appreciate, John, you coming on the show and talking about this aspect of UAVs that we don't normally hear much about other than in the news, and that doesn't give you the whole story. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's good to be with you. Hey, invite me on any time. It was good talking with you.
All right. Very good.
Well, Max, I got to admit that was worth the effort, though I need to apologize to Carlos, John, and April. It's not Customs and Border Patrol, it's Customs Border Protection. So I apologize to our listeners for being a little exuberant and getting my words wrong. So with that, but I think overall it was a really interesting discussion. How about you?
Yeah, very interesting. I found it fascinating that they utilize the same process, the same Section 333 process as everyone else when it comes to integrating into the airspace. I also thought it was very interesting that it's the same pool of pilots that are used for manned and unmanned operations.
Maybe the Air Force needs to take a lesson from that playbook to keep their retention, you know, maybe... I was thinking about, you know, that was like, oh, well, if you're getting to fly both, that's not so bad.
Very good. So I guess that about does it for this episode. One thing we wanted to mention is the Patreon hack that you may have read about in the news. Now, of course, we use Patreon as a service on the UAV Digest to help you all support the show. There was a hack of their database. It's instructive, I think, to read the notice that Patreon sent out in their blog post, just to sort of allay any concerns. They say that there was unauthorized access to registered names, email addresses, posts, and some shipping addresses. They say, we do not store full credit card numbers on our servers, and no credit card numbers were compromised. Although accessed all passwords, social security numbers, and tax form information, which wouldn't apply to patrons, remains safely encrypted with a 2048-bit RSA key. Then finally, no specific action is required of our users, but as a precaution, I recommend that all users update their passwords on Patreon. So just to let you know that, if you do have an account with Patreon, and you haven't done so already, just as an extra layer of precaution, would suggest changing your password. That's what we did, but we're not expecting any problems from this. So, just want to make sure everyone was aware.
So, I guess with that, we'll wrap this week up. I'd like to thank our listeners. Of course, if you'd like to help the show, you can send us a review on iTunes. We really need to get some more reviews up there because we don't want to lose our status as one of the number one shows on iTunes or on Stitcher. You could leave us feedback at feedback@theuavdigest.com. You can support the show via Patreon. You can support the show by buying swag at our Cafe Press store. But most of all, you can tell other listeners about us and go on our Twitter account, which is @theUAVDigest, and Facebook, which is facebook.com/theUAVDigest. So, and Max, this episode's show notes are at
theuavdigest.com/116.
So with that, this is David in Philly.
Yay, and Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.